Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Friday, November 17th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast coming from KCRG. Chillier for Friday, with an excellent weekend to follow. Dateline Cedar Falls. While temperatures will be around 15 to 20 degrees colder today for a high, we'll bounce back with somewhat warmer temperatures for the weekend. That cool down from last night's cold front actually just puts us a lot closer to normal for this time of year. Highs in the mid to upper 40s are likely for most, accompanied by full sunshine for the majority of the day. Winds out of the north or northwest will be a bit stronger this morning, but turning lighter as the day goes onward. Light winds and clear skies should be present both mornings over the weekend, setting up each day with lows in the mid to upper 20s. The drier air we'll have in place will be easy to warm up during the day, though, pushing highs into the mid to upper 50s. A bit of a westerly or southwesterly wind will help the case, along with decent amounts of sunshine. Clouds do build up later into the day on Sunday, though, with a storm system approaching. That system will track to our south, but close enough to the area to provide a chance for some showers by Monday into early Tuesday. Highs will be held back into the 40s by the clouds and showers associated with this. A stronger cold front sweeps through on Tuesday, too, leading to colder air pouring into the region on some fairly strong winds. Those winds carry us into the 30s for highs as soon as Wednesday, and likely stick around for the remainder of the holiday weekend. Lows will also fall into the 10s and low 20s on each day, making for a cold feel to the air around the clock. The good news is that the busiest travel times of Wednesday and Thursday should be clear of weather-related obstacles, with dry weather expected for the immediate area and extending further into the region. Most of Friday should be in good shape, too. This could change later on Friday night into very early Saturday, as a disturbance may develop and pass near the state. If it does, then a chance for some snow would exist during this time. Remember, this is not the coming weekend, but the following one. Due to the time frame for this being more than a week away, and a widespread of potential outcomes being shown by the computer models we use to help make our forecasts, the outcome is still fairly uncertain. Now, let's turn to the front page of today's Courier. University athletic budgets swell. UNI Athletics saw its income materialize just above expectations. The story was written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, and it opens with an action photograph of Iowa guard Caitlin Clark as she drives down the baseline against Northern Iowa on Sunday at the McLeod Center in Cedar Falls. The dateline is Iowa City. University of Iowa Athletics, in the fiscal year that just ended, beat budget expectations by $11.4 million, reaching a record $140.4 million in total income, above the $140.3 million mark the program projected to reach for the current budget year. But that $140.4 million income total for the 2023 budget year, matched by the same operating expense total, comes with an asterisk in that a portion of the overage came from, quote, a reserve fund transfer for legal settlements, according to a report that went before the Board of Regents this week at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. On the expense side, UI Athletics spent $6.8 million more than expected on, quote, administrative and general expenses, in part because of legal settlements. In March, UI Athletics paid $4.2 million to settle a discrimination lawsuit that 12 former football players filed against the department and its coaches. That's $4.2 million is about twice the amount UI Athletics had planned to spend when it agreed to the deal, expecting the state would cover $2 million of the total. quote, after listening to the concerns of Iowans and in consultation with the Board of Regents leadership, I have determined that the University of Iowa Department of Athletics will reimburse the state general fund for the $2 million due to the recent settlement, UI President Barbara Wilson said in a statement at the time. Given reserve funds are not part of making up the UI Athletics operational budget, but the department still had to pull in $4.2 million to cover the agreement. UI Athletics' operating income swelled while its reserves dropped to $2 million, according to Regents spokesman Josh Lehman. UI Athletics did generate more revenue than expected in some categories, such as for women's basketball, which was budgeted to bring in $350,000, but instead made $1.2 million. Football generated $23.8 million, more than $1 million more than the $22.8 million expected. Men's basketball brought in $3.5 million, above the budgeted $3.2 million, and men's wrestling tallied $1.2 million, topping the $750,000 expectation. UI Athletics got $2.8 million more than planned from the Big Ten Conference, but $2.7 million less than expected from donors. Hawkeye Athletics, although it didn't plan to, also ended up paying $1.5 million back to the main campus last year on a $50 million loan it borrowed during the height of COVID-19, when then UI Athletic Director Gary Barta cited such steep operating losses that he needed to cut four sports, including men's swimming, tennis, and gymnastics. Since that time, UI Athletics budgets consistently have outperformed expectations. UI Chief Financial Officer Terry Johnson told Regents Wednesday he met with Barta about the department's plan not to pay back any portion of the loan in 2023. Quote, they were intending to not make a payment in fiscal 23, but I sat down with Gary Barta, the athletic director, to talk about things, Johnson said. And after those conversations, they committed to making $1.5 million payment, unquote. To date, it has paid back $4.5 million on that loan. Starting next year, according to Johnson, payments likely will go up. Quote, I anticipate at least that they will start making larger contributions or payments toward that outstanding debt, he said. To the question of how long UI Athletics, which touts itself as self-sustaining and not relying on the main campus for financial support, will take to pay back the loan, Johnson said it has 15 years. Quote, I'm going to keep pressure as long as I'm in my role to get it paid sooner rather than later, he said. That's in their best interest as well. The interest rate gets repriced every 5 years. Now, looking at ISU and UNI and Iowa State University Athletics, which earlier this year also projected record-breaking revenue in the current budget year, nearly reached that expectation in fiscal 2023, like UI, bringing in $110.1 million, or nearly $4 million over the $106.2 million budget, and just shy of the 2024 projection of $111.5 million. All of ISU's major sports made more in ticket revenue than expected, and the department generated more income from a bump in football parking permit prices. UNI Athletics saw its income materialize just above expectations, reaching $15.5 million, which also is above the $14.8 million UNI expects to make in the current budget. But most of UNI's income increase was a $1 million bump in support from the general campus, with the larger university giving its athletics department $4.3 million instead of the planned $3.3 million. Tuition revenue. Other areas of the comprehensive university budgets show tuition revenue topped expectations at UI, but came in below budget at ISU and UNI. generating about $64.9 million instead of the expected $66.9 million. Higher indirect cost reimbursements from additional grant funding and investment income partially offset the shortage in tuition revenue, according to a UNI portion of the budget report, noting resident student tuition comprised 84% of gross tuition revenue and non-resident tuition accounted for the remaining 16%. Quote, expenditure adjustments made throughout the year offset the revenue shortfall, which reached nearly $1 million for UNI. It maintained a balanced budget by spending nearly $6.8 million less than planned on salaries. ISU's total revenue came in $1.2 million below budget because its revenue from tuition was $5.6 million under expectations. Given those shortages and other pressures, ISU spent $36.3 million more than it made and $35.1 million more than it planned, largely due to higher salary expenses. Quote, medical claims since the beginning of the pandemic have negatively impacted the fringe benefit pool over the last few years, according to the budget report. ISU made a supplemental contribution to replenish the pool during fiscal year 2023, which contributed to salary and fringe benefits costs exceeding the budget, unquote. Meanwhile, the UI brought in $15 million more in total revenue due in large part to the $12.3 million in tuition revenue than planned. Quote, higher than projected enrollments and higher percentage of non-resident students resulted in additional tuition revenue, according to the UI portion of the budget report. Quote, tuition revenue generated from resident students comprised 43% of the total, with 57% coming from non-residents, unquote. Doctors' penalties are unclear in proposed Iowa abortion rules. Story written by Tom Barton. Proposed rules, meant to provide guidance to Iowa physicians, lack specific penalties they could face for performing abortions under a new law that remains tied up in court. The Iowa Board of Medicine is set to meet Friday to consider proposed rules that include specific guidance on how medical providers are to implement the exceptions for rape, incest, fatal fetal abnormalities, and medical emergencies contained in a new law that would prohibit the vast majority of abortions in the state. The proposed rules, however, leave unanswered key questions as to whether doctors could face fines or licensing repercussions for performing abortions illegally. They simply state, quote, failure to comply with this rule or the requirements of Iowa Code Section 146E may constitute grounds for discipline, unquote. Existing administrative rules lay out the extent of the punishment the Board of Medicine can impose on physicians and licensees who violate board rules and state laws. The board may revoke, suspend, or restrict someone's license, or place them on a probation period, or require additional education or training. The board may also impose a fine up to $10,000 and issue a citation and warning. Republican lawmakers and supporters of the law say the exceptions allow medical providers to exercise judgment and provide abortions when they believe one applies. Opponents contend the uncertainty and worry among physicians of potentially losing their medical license could prompt providers to put off abortions if they're uncertain. A Polk County District Court judge in July granted a request from Iowa abortion providers to halt enforcement of the new restrictions until its constitutionality can be considered by the courts. Planned Parenthood North Central States, the Emma Goldman Clinic, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa requested the injunction. The judge's ruling, however, left in place a provision directing the Iowa Board of Medicine to adopt rules to administer the bill. In the wake of Iowa and U.S. Supreme Court rulings, reversing a fundamental right to abortion. Republican leaders in the state, including Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd, argued the district court decision to grant the injunctions was in error and have asked the Iowa Supreme Court to lift it. The Iowa Supreme Court agreed in July to hear the appeal. Oral arguments in the case have not yet been scheduled. Quote, "The injunction placed on Iowa's fetal heartbeat law has already led to the innocent deaths of children," unquote, Governor Kim Reynolds said in a statement last week in response to a brief filed by Byrd in the state's appeal with the Iowa Supreme Court. As the case continues, abortion in Iowa remains legal up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. What the law does. The law, House File 732, would change the amount of time women have to seek an abortion from 20 weeks post-fertilization to as little as 6 weeks, and that's before many women even know they're pregnant. The legislation prohibits abortions after cardiac activity is detected in an embryo. The law requires doctors to perform an abdominal ultrasound on a patient seeking an abortion if cardiac activity, defined as, quote, "the steady and repetitive rhythm contraction of the fetal heart within the gestational sac," is detected, the abortion cannot be performed unless one of the exceptions has been met. The bill includes exceptions for pregnancies that are the result of rape in cases reported within 45 days, and incest in the cases reported within 140 days. It also includes exceptions for miscarriages, a fetal abnormality that would result in the infant's death, and for when the mother's life is threatened. An attorney for Planned Parenthood Federation of America argued in court that the law, quote, "unquestionably imposes an undue burden on Iowans' access to abortion care and violates their constitutional rights to due process, dominion over one's body, the ability to, quote, have control over their lives and their futures, and to make their own decisions about their health care. Planned Parenthood has said the ban would prohibit an estimated 98% of all abortions in Iowa. While the ban contains some exceptions for abortions, some Iowa physicians have warned the restrictions do not account for complications that occur during pregnancy and would hinder their ability to provide care and respond to time-sensitive issues. Proposed rules. Under the proposed rules to determine whether patients qualify for the ban's exceptions for rape and incest, Iowa physicians would be required to gather details from women to determine when and whether a sex act occurred, including if and when the act was first reported to law enforcement, a public or private health agency, or a family physician. Doctors would be required to document the information in the patient's medical records and make a, quote, "good faith assessment that the woman is being truthful," and may require them to attest the information was true and accurate to the best of her understanding, unquote. As for determining whether a fetus has an abnormality, quote, "that in the physician's reasonable medical judgment is incompatible with life," doctors would be required to document diagnostic tests and procedures performed and their results, along with a description as to why they support the diagnosis. Exceptions too vague. Iowa Representative Amy Nelson, a Democrat from North Liberty, said exceptions for rape and incest may work in theory, but not in reality. Nielsen said the rules make it unclear how a provider is supposed to validate a patient's accusation of rape or incest and may feel scared to act due to fear they will be prosecuted if they act outside the law. Additionally, women may be too scared to come forward when they've been raped. About two-thirds of victims do not report to law enforcement. Many know their abuser and worry about the consequences, according to national statistics compiled by the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. Nielsen said the rules call for doctors to ask specific and invasive questions that could expose women to additional trauma by having to relive the crime. And she argued the rules and exceptions are, quote, worded vaguely enough that doctors are going to be wary, unquote. Dr. Emily Bowers, an obstetrician gynecologist in Waverly, agreed, adding the Board of Medicine was put in a difficult spot of drafting rules for what she said is a deeply concerning law that mandates medically trained professionals to try to interpret legal concepts of what constitutes rape to provide standard medical care. And in doing so, the law requires physicians to have patients, quote, recall horrific details to document the legal details of an assault to satisfy the curiosity of the government, unquote. Quote, that's not what the medical record is intended to, for, and that's not what physicians are trained for, and that's not their role in our society, Bowers said. She said doctors fearing legal repercussions risk grave patient harm to comply, including letting patients' conditions deteriorate until they threaten the patient's life. Quote, what physician is going to want to come and practice in this environment, where you stake your license on what constitutes rape appropriately and get called before the Board of Medicine to determine what your discipline is, Bowers said. And we don't know what those actions might cost us. It's incredible, unquote. And at a time, she said, when Iowa has the lowest number of OBGYN specialists per capita of any state in the country, and infant mortality in the state has soared more than any other. Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta, who led floor debate on the bill in the House, did not respond to a message seeking comment Tuesday. A spokesperson for the Iowa House Republicans also did not return a message on Tuesday. The decision makers. The Iowa Board of Medicine licenses and regulates physicians, acupuncturists, and other healthcare providers. The board is composed of 10 members, 5 practicing doctors of medicine, 2 practicing doctors of osteopathic medicine, and 3 members of the public. State law requires no more than 5 members may be affiliated with the same political party. Members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Iowa Senate. If approved by the board, the rules then go before the legislature's Administrative Rules Review Committee, which votes to approve or reject them. The 10-member committee of the House and Senate lawmakers is comprised of 6 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Once the committee approves the initial proposal, the board may make changes to the wording based on feedback and can then adopt the rules. Should the Board of Medicine vote to move ahead with the proposed rules, that would open a public comment period through January 2nd. The draft rules, along with all comments received, would return to the board for review and consideration of a vote to adopt the rules at its January 26th board meeting. The rules go into effect 35 days after the final review. Police chief's decision to euthanize dog was upheld by Cedar Falls Council. Story written by Andy Malone. Dateline Cedar Falls. The City Council has upheld the decision of Police Chief Mark Howard to euthanize a College Hill couple's beloved pit bull after it viciously bit 5 people on different occasions over approximately 2 years. Leanne and Chris Western of the 1400 block of 18th Street appealed the chief's decision to put down the 80-pound brown and white pit bull named Reese because of his belief that the dog is a danger to the public. The council agreed with the chief in a 6-0 vote Thursday during a meeting of the administrative committee at the Public Safety Center. Councilmember Dave Sires was absent. Chris Western noted afterwards, though, quote, we're not done. They plan to appeal to district court. Quote, we're very sad and very disappointed, said Leanne Western. Her husband muttered, I was surprised it was unanimous, unquote. The latest incident involved the 3.5-year-old pet came on October 4th at a relative's home in the 1300 block of Clark Drive. The dog went after a teenager biking on a sidewalk. Leanne Western was issued an at-large dog infraction. A couple incidents described Thursday involved public safety officers, including one officer who was bitten at the front door of the couple's home while investigating a suspicious vehicle. The first incident dated back to May of 2021. Reese had already been on a tight leash before the final straw on October 4th. Howard previously recommended the dog be euthanized and deferred to counsel's advice to allow the dog to be released to the family due to certain circumstances and as long as several conditions were fulfilled. Chris Western blamed past issues at their residence on the fact that the couple had a doggy door they later got rid of as one condition of the agreement with the city. He called the dog a, quote, beloved member of the community and brother to another pit bull named Riley. At least one person in the audience could be heard snickering at that remark. It's the third time Howard has ordered a dog be euthanized since taking the reins as the acting chief, March 2022, and eventually becoming the head of the city's police division. Chapter 6 of City Code gives the chief the authority to make the call, clearly not one he enjoys making, and it also outlines the process for appeal under the council's purview. He twice made the recommendation to euthanize Reese. In the summer of 2022, he made a similar recommendation when a pit bull attacked a Yorkie, leaving it in critical condition. The owner of the Yorkie decided to euthanize her own dog to put it out of its misery. The chief's decision also was unanimously upheld by the council in August of that year. Howard says calls of domestic animals attacking other domestic animals are becoming more common. He believes the complaints become frequent with owners now more likely to report the incidents because they treat their pets like family. Quote, I think we'll see more and more of these cases, he said of Thursday's proceedings. After the committee heard the arguments from both sides, reviewed evidence, and heard witness testimony in public session, the quasi-judicial body deliberated in closed session, as is allowed under state law. The committee discussed the matter for less than a half hour before emerging to take the vote in public. Quote, these decisions are very difficult, council member Simon Harding, who chaired the meeting, said afterwards. Quote, no one on the committee took it lightly. They weighed the facts and put a lot of thought into their vote, unquote. At least two council members expressed their sympathies about the decision to the couple afterwards. Harding wanted to share the reason for his vote, but ultimately declined out of precaution because of deliberations having taken place in closed session. Couple opens the Nook bookstore on Main Street in Cedar Falls. Story by Angela Sturm McLaughlin. Dateline Cedar Falls. Abby Olson has been a fan of books her whole life. Her first foray into literature was creating an Instagram account where she talked about the books she liked and then reviewed them. Her ultimate goal was to create a community of book fans that was all-inclusive and encompassed all genres. She and her husband, Brandon Conrad, now have a place to nurture that community. On Saturday, the recently married couple opened The Nook, an independent bookstore at 216 Main Street. Quote, I can rarely tell her no, Conrad said about Olson with a shy smile. Quote, she has all of the ideas, unquote. As they opened their doors, there was a line around the block. Some of the people had been waiting in the cold for hours. By the end of the weekend, half of their inventory was gone. Quote, having a bookstore where people can come and relax has been my number one goal for a while, Olson said. I'm glad we are able to find a space that fits us and we want to create, unquote. The couple created Sage Candle Company in 2022 and started selling candles in many stores and at farmers markets across Cedar Valley. That fall, Olson's family created The Patch. Part of the business was a pop-up bookstore that was curated to fit within the theme of the location. The bookstore is in the former location of Miss Wonderful, a vintage store that closed earlier this year. When first building Sage Candle Company, Conrad reached out to Ann Eastman, who owned Miss Wonderful. She put in one of Sage Candle Company's first wholesale orders. It was a case of serendipity when Eastman decided to close her store earlier this year. It spurred Olson and Conrad to pursue their dream of creating a bookstore. Quote, "We kept in contact with the people on Main Street and let them know that we wanted to have a store. To end up here, where Miss Wonderful was, is a full circle moment," Olson said. Quote, "We are so excited to be one of the only independent booksellers in the area," she added. "We plan on offering support to local authors and have a few book clubs. In the next year, Olson and Conrad plan on continuing to build their brands as well as grow the Nook. They are expecting to start a full-service website for the store." As people begin their holiday shopping, Olson hopes that the Nook is a place people will consider rather than chain retailers. Quote, "When I think of some place that I want to shop, I want to go to a place where you can buy a gift and meet some cool people," she said. "We plan on being here for a long time," unquote. And listeners, we just want to take a moment now to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November 17th on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now this announcement.
What if, instead of looking down on people struggling with using drugs, we saw them as people instead? People who have interests and passions, people who have loved ones they care about, and loved ones who care about them. They have a very powerful illness, and they need help and support so they can live the life they want and deserve. See the person, not the addiction. Learn more at yourliveiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial was written by Art Cullen and appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot. Reynolds goes for broke on right-wing crusades. Governor Kim Reynolds is doubling down on a right-wing agenda rejected by voters in Iowa and across the country on Tuesday. Reynolds is arguing for a 6-week abortion ban before the Iowa Supreme Court in the wake of a wave of votes in Ohio, Virginia, and Kentucky favoring abortion rights. Across Iowa, voters rejected her education agenda by wiping out the Moms for Liberty candidates from Carroll to Ankeny. In Pella, a measure to give the city council veto power over library books failed. Yet, the governor persists. She endorsed Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, and her political kindred spirit, just as his cutter was taking on water. Donald Trump declared her finished. The Alta Aurelia School Board takes the governor's Department of Education very seriously, having walled off the children from the Alta Public Library. She warned school administrators just last week that the law is very clear about no mention of the birds and the bees in the classrooms. The Storm Lake School Board made it clear it had no intention of banning books or changing its curriculum to repress gays. The three incumbent candidates, all fairly moderate types, ran unopposed. Iowans polled for moderation in this off-year election. They elected Reynolds to cut taxes, not to chase off queers or patrol the Mexican border. She delivered on the tax cuts, but couldn't stop. She pressed on with private school vouchers, hugely unpopular. All the talk about sexuality made people uncomfortable all the way around. Not good politics. Our state highways are terrible. Nursing homes are closing on meager Medicaid reimbursement. Average people are not invested in culture wars. They want good jobs, clean water, sound schools, and a safe home for grandma. That's perhaps why Reynolds is the most unpopular governor in the United States. according to a Morning Consult poll. She has a 47% disapproval rating, up sharply just this year. DeSantis is number two for least popular. Birds of a feather flock together. So few people like you. Stick with your obnoxious friends. While her approval with Republicans in Iowa is high, Reynolds is tanking among independents. The more she hangs around DeSantis, the more she is perceived as mean. It doesn't wear well. Republicans are unlikely to lose their large majorities in the Iowa House or Senate in the 2024 cycle. But Reynolds is setting herself up for defeat as the GOP suffered huge losses in the suburbs around Des Moines and Cedar Rapids that once were thought safe turf. Reynolds also is turning off friends in the deep red Northwest Iowa, who may not be as motivated to donate or even vote in 2026, when she presumably stands for re-election. They like Trump out here. They remember. State Auditor Rob Sand is best positioned to take her on. He is the only statewide elected Democratic office holder. He has long insisted that he is a nonpartisan, which is a good look these days as voters hate both parties. He is from Decorah, with rural bona fides, including dead turkey and deer. He can raise money. Reynolds has not faced a strong challenger. Fred Hubble had lots of money, which turns out to be his liability. Deidre Dejere had no money, which was her main liability. Sand will have cash without corporate baggage, but a populist he is not. He is a careful lawyer. The ground is shifting beneath Reynolds' feet, but it does not look like she feels the tremors. She just keeps digging in. Her mentor, Terry Branstad, would find a way to keep Trump close with one eye on the exit. He was fairly clever in co-opting the teachers' union. Reynolds has energized the Iowa State Education Association by gutting collective bargaining and fostering the Moms for Liberty. If you want to lose ground in rural Iowa, fight the teachers and the school boards. She has won two elections, but the third one might be a lot harder. The injuries are self-inflicted. Overreach is irresistible when the table is yours. Reynolds could have delivered tax cut on top of tax cut without all the cultural sideshow theatrics that Iowans would prefer not to deal with. They want responsible limits on abortion, but not a fetal heartbeat ban. They want discretion in their curriculum, but they would prefer teachers and principals sorted out, not the preachers and zealots. They wonder why their taxes are so high and Highway 7 is so bad. This is ripe ground for an opponent calling for moderation. Reynolds shows no sign of backing off her moral crusades, soundly rejected in Pella and Carroll, of all places. Next, we have an editorial titled Food and Peace, and it was written by Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times-Pilot. Tensions were running especially high when we suggested a while back that Chinese leader Xi Jinping should sit down for supper with his old friends from Iowa, which he visited as a young regional technocrat 38 years ago. Food brings people together. Iowa is the biggest supplier of pork and soy to China. When misunderstandings arise, it is always good to sit down and talk over food. Turns out, a delegation of Iowans have been invited to San Francisco this week for a supper with Xi and President Joe Biden. It includes many of the people who hosted Xi when he first visited Iowa to learn more about production agriculture. Quote, "This has been a heck of a journey. We can't figure it out. We don't even know why he likes us," Sarah Landy told reporter Jennifer Jacobs. Sarah, now 85, and her husband Roger, hosted Xi at their Muscatine farm on his first visit, coordinated by then-Governor Terry Branstad. Branstad has been invited to the supper as well. He served as ambassador to China during the Trump administration. This homecoming of sorts could not have happened without the support of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's part of an effort to repair a relationship that has become dangerously frayed over the past decade over trade, human rights, and threats to Taiwan. A trade war launched during the Trump administration undermined decades of relationship building among Iowa ag interests and Asia. It confirmed Chinese suspicions that the United States will use food as a trade weapon, prompting it to shift trade to South America. All the tough talk leads to fears of military confrontation. China needs food and agricultural technology. It has a restive population that demands more protein from a food system challenged by natural resource depletion and climate change. We must come together to find a way to feed a growing world population and calm conflict. The Middle East is exploding into what may be an expanded war as the U.S. strikes bases in Syria, manned by Iran, and stocked by Russia. Bombs rain down on Ukraine and into the Gaza Strip. The civil war in Yemen could not continue were it not for the U.S. and China backing Saudi Arabia and Iran as proxies. The United States and China can do a lot to stop the bombs. Iowa can help focus our attention where it needs to be, on our common interests. China, in the near term, needs food from Iowa. In the long term, its top national goal is food self-sufficiency. That's why the Iowans are on the guest list. As purveyors of food and ways to produce it in a rapidly changing environment, Iowans bring value to the table as pragmatic friends who want peace and sovereignty. Citizen diplomacy put Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev in a lunch table on the Roswell Garst farm during the height of the Cold War. Khrushchev marveled at Iowa ag productivity. It helped to keep the guns at bay. Likewise, Xi was impressed with what he saw. We also have learned a lot about food system resiliency in the past couple of decades and how we can collaborate to feed people without taking out the Brazilian rainforest. It's good to keep talking. U.S. and China military commanders have resumed their communications. China just ordered up a jumbo tonnage of soy just ahead of the Biden-Xi summit. These are good steps. We hope that it leads to more joint agricultural and food exchanges that lead to understanding and progress. The first order of maintaining the peace is making certain that people are fed. It is gratifying and important that Iowa has a seat at the table. We hope it can lead to a reprise of Xi's visit to Iowa and a strengthening of bridges between world superpowers. Reasoning with China starts with food, plain and simple. President Biden and Secretary Vilsack are smart to recognize it and leverage the relationship that Branstad, Lodi, et al. Built with Xi over the years. He has remained in correspondence with the Landes for nearly four decades. It is easier to talk about human rights, Taiwan, and Iran on a full stomach. Xi may be more reasonable, knowing that the United States is a reliable supplier of crop staples when Russia is not, and that the key to gaining influence in the developing world is through sustainable food production. What a tremendous opportunity for peace. Now from the New York Times, Trump wants us to know he will stop at nothing in 2025. This editorial was written by Jamel Bowie. Over the past few weeks, we've gotten a pretty good idea of what Donald Trump would do if given a second chance in the White House. And it is neither exaggeration nor hyperbole to say that it looks an awful lot like a set of plans meant to give the former president the power and unchecked authority of a strongman. Trump would purge the federal government of as many civil servants as possible. In their place, he would install an army of political and ideological loyalists whose fealty to Trump's interests would stand far and above their commitment to either the rule of law or the Constitution. With the help of these unscrupulous allies, Trump plans to turn the Department of Justice against his political opponents, prosecuting his critics and rivals. He would use the military to crush protests under the Insurrection Act, which he hoped to do during the summer of 2020, and turn the power of the federal government against his perceived enemies. Quote, if I happen to be president and I see somebody who's doing well and beating me very badly, I say, go down and indict them. They'd be out of business. They'd be out of the election, unquote. Trump said that in a recent interview on the Spanish language network Univision. As the former president wrote in a disturbing and authoritarian-minded Veterans Day message to supporters, itself echoing a speech he delivered that same day to supporters in New Hampshire, quote, we pledge to you that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, lie, steal, and cheat on elections, and will do everything possible, whether legally or illegally, to destroy America and the American dream, unquote. Trump has other plans as well. As several of my Times colleagues reported last week, he hopes to institute a program of mass detainment and deportation of undocumented immigrants. His aides have already drawn up plans for new detention centers at the U.S.-Mexico border, where anyone suspected of illegal entry would be held until authorities have settled the person's immigration status. Given the former president's rhetoric attacking political enemies and other supposedly undesirable groups, like the homeless, Trump has said that the government should remove homeless Americans and put them in tents on large parcels of inexpensive land in the outer reaches of the cities. There's little doubt that some citizens would find themselves in these large and sprawling camps. Included in this effort to rid the United States of as many immigrants as possible is a proposal to target people here legally, like green card holders or people on student visas who harbor supposedly, quote, jihadist sympathies or espouse views deemed anti-American. Trump also intends to circumvent the 14th Amendment so that he can end birthright citizenship for the children of unauthorized immigrants. In the past, Trump has gestured at seeking a third term in office after serving a second four-year term in the White House. Quote, we are going to win four more years, Trump said during his 2020 campaign. And then after that, we'll go for another 4 years because they spied on my campaign. We should get a redo of 4 years. This, too, would violate the Constitution. But then, in a world in which Trump gets his way on his authoritarian agenda, the Constitution and the rule of law would already be a dead letter. It might be tempting to dismiss the former president's rhetoric and plans as either jokes or the ravings of a lunatic who may eventually find himself in jail. But to borrow an overused phrase, it is important to take the words of both presidents and presidential candidates seriously as well as literally. They may fail. In fact, they often do. But presidents try to keep their campaign promises and act on their campaign plans. In a rebuke to those who urged us not to take him literally in 2016, we saw Trump attempt to do what he said he would do during his first term in office. He said he would, quote, build a wall, and he tried to build a wall. He said he would try to keep Muslims out of the country, and he tried to keep Muslims out of the country. He said he would do as much as he could to restrict immigration from Mexico, and he did much as he could, and then some, to restrict immigration from Mexico. He even suggested in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election that he would reject an election defeat. 4 years later, he lost his bid for re-election. We know what happened next. In addition to Trump's words, which we should treat as a reliable guide to his actions, desires, and preoccupations, we have allies who are as open in their contempt for democracy as Trump is, ensconced at institutions like the Heritage Foundation and the Claremont Institute. Trump's political and ideological allies have made no secret of their desire to install a reactionary Caesar at the head of the American state. As Damon Linker noted this month in his essay on these figures for Time's Opinion, they exist to give Republican elites permission and encouragement to do things that just a few years ago would have been considered unthinkable. Americans are obsessed with hidden meanings and secret relations. This is why many of us are taken with the tell-all memoirs of political operatives or historical materials like the Nixon tapes. We often pay the most attention to those things that have been hidden from view. But the mundane truth of American politics is that much of what we want to know is in plain view. We don't have to search hard or seek it out. You just have to listen. And Donald Trump is telling us loud and clear that he wants to end American democracy as we know it. Next, we have voters' angst prevails over America's 2024 political landscape, written by Art Cullen and appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot. Here we are, 1 year before the November 5th, 2024 election, and a recent Pew Research Center poll reveals 65% of Americans say they always or often feel exhausted when thinking about politics. 55% feel angry, let alone disgusted. Furthermore, 63% of Americans say they are dissatisfied with the candidates who have emerged so far. Most Americans are critical of the role of money in politics, and inter- and intra-party campaign fighting starts way too early in the election cycle. Wouldn't it be nice if we had the same pre-election campaign starting date as Canada, 11 weeks, Mexico, 90 days, or France, 2 weeks? Tradition held that people seeking any office didn't start their campaign until the year of the election. Jimmy Carter, a Democrat from Georgia, broke the accepted protocol when he announced his 1976 presidential candidacy on December 12, 1974. Pundits are already making predictions about the presidential, Senate, and House outcome. Let's preview their pre-election analysis. For the presidential election, the nonpartisan and independent Road to 270 2024 presidential election map claims the Democratic Party has already sewed up 241 Electoral College votes, needing only 29 more to reach the 270 magic number. GOP is touted to have 235 votes in their pocket, 35 electoral votes short of winning the presidency. The Dems can remain in the White House if states in just one of these six scenarios vote blue: Pennsylvania and Georgia, Pennsylvania and Arizona, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, and Georgia, Wisconsin, and Nevada. For the Republican Party, they only have five vote red winning combinations to flip the presidency back to GOP controlled. And those five are: number one, Pennsylvania and Georgia; number two, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Wisconsin; number three, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Nevada; and number four, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Nevada; and number five, Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin. Registered voters in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin will be inundated with the D and R presidential candidates' time, money, and respective disinformation, misinformation, propaganda, door-to-door persuasion, media saturation, and political campaign energy. But voters in the other 45 states are not off the hook. In the Senate election, currently Democrats' Senate caucus is composed of 51 members, 48 Democrats, and 3 independents. 49 members make up the GOP's Senate. Of the 33 Senate races in 2024, 20 Democrats and 10 Republicans and 3 independents are seeking re-election. The independent and nonpartisan Cook Political Report feels there are 3 major toss-up elections. Those are, number 1, Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, who's an independent. Number 2 is Ohio's Sherrod Brown, a Democrat. And number 3, West Virginia's Joe Manchin, a Democrat. Legal issues may endanger Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, returning to D.C. for his 4th term of office. Don't be surprised by the Democrats losing control of the Senate. And now the House of Representatives election. Of the 435 House elections in 2024, CPR thinks the Democrats and Republicans will each win over 200 seats, but there are 24 races classified as deadlocked. 10 currently controlled Democrat seats in the nail-biter category include Colorado's Yadira Carreveo, Michigan's Elisa Slotkin, North Carolina's Kathy Manning, Wiley Nickel, and Jeff Jackson, New Mexico's Gabe Vasquez, Ohio's Amelia Sykes, Pennsylvania's Susan Wild and Matt Cartwright, and Washington's Marie Perez. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November 17th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of today's reading of the Courier or the reading of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we'd like to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.